Real life Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort, is here tonight.
Jordan Belfort, entrepreneurs, speaker, and bestseller, portrayed as by Leo DiCaprio on The Wolf of Wall Street.
I was a born entrepreneur. Sell me this pen. How to close the richest, toughest, meanest investors out there. And the first trade was $120,000. My profit on that was $72,000. That's one trade. And the guy apologized for working so small. In that moment, I knew. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to be a billionaire.
Legendary Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort.
Hollywood has made Jordan Belfort into a big story.
Sales now becomes a numbers game.
AI's going to take your job, but the only job it won't take is if you're a deal maker.
I'm going to just say flat out to the camera, whether you like it or not, this is happening. In the next 3 to 5 years, businesses are going to fundamentally be disrupted at very deep levels.
Jordan Belfort, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
I think everybody's a huge fan of you in the business world. The Wolf of Wall Street, the movie, it is the best movie of all time, isn't it? And I'm not just saying that because you're sat here.
You know, listen, it's definitely up there. I mean, the thing with The Wolf of Wall Street is you can watch it again and again.
Yeah,
and
man.
It's one of those movies, right?
Yeah,
there's a
man.
Few of them that are like that. You can watch them again and again and again. Like The Godfather, you know, Godfather 2. I've seen each of those 10 times, you know, Scarface. I have my favorites. But listen, I mean, I love The Wolf of Wall Street. I think I love the first 2/3 of it.
Yeah, when you were really with it.
When things are really fun and cool. Nah, but it's a great movie, and Leo did a great job with Scorsese, so yeah. And Margot Robbie, too, you know.
Well, I remember when I first met you, actually, it was 5 years ago when you were last in London, and there was a VIP dinner. I think it was Greg Secker that was organizing
it. An old friend of mine.
Yeah. And I came down to the dinner, paid the extra £2,000-£3,000 or whatever it was, came to the dinner, met you, and I thought, man, I want to get Jordan back to the UK at some point. Obviously, I've learned a lot from you about sales. You've written a lot of sales books. But I want to really delve into that and talk about sales and try and draw as much as I can for the viewers. Because I think sales is probably the most important skill in business. If you can't sell, sales is money, isn't it?
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, listen, you could have the greatest, you know, value proposition, you know, in the world. But if you can't get that point across to someone else in a way that they understand, it makes them want to not just buy, so to speak, but buy now. In other words, it's also, you know, buying and buying now versus people saying, yeah, it sounds great, I like it, but they aren't up to the point of where they're going to make that decision. Right. So I think someone that knows how to sell and influence correctly knows how to really get their point across on a very deep level, both logically and emotionally. And by doing that, you get someone to see things the way that you see them. In other words, you're the person that's influencing. Well, you know how great what you have is, right? And that's why you're trying to sell it, you promote it, right? You know the value proposition, the cost-benefit ratio, but the person that you're trying to convince or persuade, they don't know what you know. So the real question, what sales really is how do you convey what you know and transfer the certainty that you have about that to the other person in a way that connects with them and doesn't piss them off, because, like, you know, people will do it, and they do it in a way called hard selling, which pisses people off. So there's certain rules and to the game. You can't just, like, say, this is the best truck. That's not going to work. So that's really what sales is.
I mean, sales generally has a bit of a bad rep, I think, especially in the UK. Maybe not so much in America, I'm not sure. But if you say salesman, people think pushy, sleazy, slimy, manipulative, negative connotations. You don't think salesperson, oh, great.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, number one is I think that one of the biggest misconceptions is that sales is just for salespeople. Like, I don't care what line of work you're in, whether it's business or personal, we're always in some way selling, trying to get our points across to other people, people to see things the way that we see them, or at least you can engage in some negotiation, right? So without that skill, it's very difficult to succeed in life. And I think it's like the cliche, even in The Wolf of Wall Street, where you see them like on the phone banging away, right? And and while they did bang away, there was this, what they were taught and what I've refined over the years is not to do it in a way that makes people feel like they're being pushed and it's shoved down their throat. It's far more elegant than that. In fact, if you're really doing it the right way, especially as the system has evolved over time, right? Remember, that's back in the early 90s, right? You know, it's really more about asking a lot of questions in the beginning.
Yeah.
There's like different phases of like, you know, trying to really find out what a person's pain points are, what their values are, why they need the product, and then tailoring your presentation to that, but in a way with the straight line system.
Yeah. I'm interested in the straight line system. I mean, I've read your books and studied some of your sales teachings and used it and adapted it, and I've got my kind of my own thing.
Yeah.
But talk to me
Which is great, by the way. I love that. I love when people take it and they adapt it because it's always the same, but it's like the rules are the same, but it's different how you apply it to certain industries. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Different industries, different cultures. But talk to me about what is the essence of the straight line system? What does it mean? And how did you come up with that concept? And when did you come up with that concept? Yeah.
So I came up with this concept after trying to train a bunch of barely post-adolescent nincompoops, okay, who, you know, barely clawed their way out of high school. I was trying to teach them how to close the richest, toughest, meanest investors out there, like rich top 5% of 3% of United States business owners back in the day. People with, you know, $10 million net worths and above, right? So I guess now it would be more like $30 million. Net. Yeah. Back then, $10 million was a lot of money. Even a million was a lot of money back then, right? So what happened before that is I had a different type of firm. It was a penny stock firm, and we was calling average moms and pops. And when you did a transaction, it was maybe $300, $500. It was more of an impulse sale, right? And it was much easier versus calling sophisticated businessmen and trying to sell them $500,000 or $1 million of a $5 or $10 stock. It wasn't penny stocks anymore, right? So the system I was using for penny stocks was great. And it was like, you know, it didn't have a name, but I was awesome at like teaching tonality and all these different things and overcoming objections, right? And it worked. And the average salesman was making about $10,000, $15,000 a month back then, right? Double it for today's dollars, right? Or pounds. And then I stumbled upon this untapped niche, which was calling the rich people, right? And when I tested that idea out with my junior partner, Danny, the Jonah Hill character, right? The results that we got was so staggeringly awesome. Like 100 times better.
Really?
Yeah, like with the first trade, Danny got the first trade, right? We were dialing together. He got the first person on the phone. And the first trade was $180,000, $120,000. And it was 20,000 shares of a $6 stock, $120, $10,000, right? My commission, my profit on that was $72,000. Now, that's one trade. And the guy apologized for working so small. Now, in the penny stock world, you did a trade for $300, maybe made $160, right? I mean, it was so much bigger. And I was like, and in that moment, I figured out the system of how you get to these people, separate issue, right? And in that moment, I knew, I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna be a billionaire. Like, I'm gonna be the richest 25-year-old in America, right? And I looked out into my boardroom there, you know, where all the brokers were sitting. I said, God, this is gonna be easy, you know? All I have to do is train these 12 kids, you know, who, you know, clawed their way out of high school, right? Barely acquainted with a razor blade, still have acne. All I got to do is train these 12 kids to do what I can do and Danny can do, and I'm going to be a billionaire. Well, unfortunately, you know, as they say, easier said than done. It turned out that trying to train a bunch of barely post-adolescent nincompoops wasn't difficult, like the end to call the richest, meanest businessman. It was impossible. And after a month of trying everything, I tried everything, other systems, I read books on sales, and I even flew out to California to a seminar, which had purportedly the great sales trainers back then, and I quickly realized that their stuff wasn't nearly as good as what I was teaching, right? And what I was teaching wasn't working either. So I was stuck, right? So I came back to the firm, and this is back in 1988, believe it or not, was that 36 years ago? It's crazy, right? 36 years ago, and the system's only gotten 1,000 times better since then, right? And I walked in, at this point, like the brokers, it was 12 of them, they wanted to quit because they weren't making money. They hadn't closed a sale in 1 month, not even one sale. Meanwhile, my closing rate was 50%. Danny's was in the high 30s, right? Now, what would you do is, Matt, you're real estate, but imagine you have a real estate company, right? and you're going out there and you're closing 50% of your deals, and your other guy, your right-hand guy, he's closing 38%, and then you have 15 people or 12 people, and they can't close even one.
Well, I wouldn't want them on the phone. They're taking my leads.
Just imagine. Let's say you had unlimited leads.
Okay.
Because we had unlimited leads. Unlimited, right? So let's say, what would you be thinking? Like, what the fuck is going on here?
Yeah.
Right? Like, and I was already a great sales trainer. I was. People would listen to my meetings, and they were powerful. And I'm like, what is it? It would shock you, right? You couldn't figure it out. Like, we're calling the same leads, giving the same pitch, same words, right? And I'm like, what is going on? And when I got back, they like wanted to go back to selling penny stocks, I was so sick of doing that, right? So they wanted me to give one of these marathon sales training sessions, which I would do it from time to time. I'd get up for 3 hours at night and go through everything, right? So we all decided to come back 7 p.m., get in the boardroom. It's like this dilapidated old boardroom I had in the beginning, right? And I was keeping overhead low, right? And I look into their sad faces. I'm standing at the front, my whiteboard behind me, right? And I'm like, guys, I don't understand what's wrong with you. I mean, I'm doing this, making a fortune. Danny's doing it, he's making a fortune. I know you can do it too. What's the problem, right? And there was silence in the beginning. I was really angry at this point. I was like, because this billion-dollar idea, I saw it going by the wayside, right? I'm like, what is the problem, guys? Tell me. Honestly, we're not leaving until we figure this out. And after about a minute, someone goes, there's too many objections. And someone else goes, yeah, there's 1,000 objections. We can't even get our pitches off. We're getting cut off. Another goes, yeah, the rich people are assholes. The moms and pops are much better. And another goes, yeah, there's 1,000 objections. And I'm like, really? There's 1,000 objections? They're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, great. Let's write them all down.
Right.
I want to write them down. And I said, come on. And my plan was I was going to go through each one by one, and I was going to show them how I would overcome each objection, right? So first they say they want to think about it. Another guy says they want to call back. Someone else says bad time of year. Someone else says they want to speak to their wife. I don't have money, and on. And they got to like six, and like they stopped. I'm like, guys, that's six. We have 994 to go. I want to know all of them. And on and on they went until they finally ran out of objections, which at the end of the day turned out to be, I think it was 14 fucking objections.
Mm-hmm.
And they were done.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't come up with anything else, right? And in that moment, I got so angry because I'm looking at these like sad, negative faces, and like something just boiled up inside. I'm like, you guys are unfucking believable, You're all whining and crying about these 1,000 objections, Meanwhile, at the end of the day, there's 14, and honestly, half of them are repeats of two. It was like, I want to speak to my wife, my business partner, my accountant, someone else. Or it's a bad time of year. It's tax time. It's back to school time. It's fucking Groundhog's Day. It's leap year. And I got so angry. I said, guys, you're really unbelievable. All this shit with this 1,000 objections. But you know what? There's only seven. And even those don't matter. And I'm like, don't you guys get it? And suddenly, this thought pops in my head that never had popped in my head before. I said, don't you guys get it? Every sale is the same. And they looked at me like, what? You could see by their expressions, every sale is not the same. Every sale is different. People have different needs, different values. They say different things. They have different experiences, different amounts of money. How could every sale be the same? I'm like, guys, every sale is the same. I'm like, watch. And I'm like, and this idea pops in my head. I'm like, it's a straight line. I turn to the board, I draw this long, thin, straight line across the center of the whiteboard. I put a big, thick X on either end and say, guys, this is the open where the sale begins. This is the close where the client says, yeah, let's do it. I said, and every once in a while, when you would get one of these perfect, what we call lay down sales, where they're like pre-sold before they even start. Yeah. And I'm sure you get them.
Of course.
Right. Well, like everything you said, like, oh my God, that sounds so great. And you're like, it costs, oh my God, it's so cheap. And they said, oh my God, what a great, like, it's like they say, nope, objectionless sale. And the first time you ask them to buy, they're like, great, where do I sign? Right? Yeah. We call that a lay down in straight line parlance, right? And we love those. It's great. I'm so happy. I'd rather have a lay down. But they're few and far between. That's not what typically happens, right? What typically happens is you would love it to keep it on this perfect straight line where everything you say they agree with, no interruptions, no objections, right? But they typically object, they cut you off, they have questions, concerns, right? So you want to keep them on the line. They have a tendency to go off the line. So what you need to have are these healthy boundaries above and below the line. And when you're inside these boundaries, you're in control of the sale. When you go outside the boundaries, then you've lost control. They're in control and you're spiraling off to Pluto or Uranus, where the fuck it is, right? Mm. You're spiraling off out of control, right? And when you're in control in the sale, what you're doing is two things. Number one, you're building rapport in the beginning and then creating and building on that rapport as you're slowly moving someone down the line. And what I said to them is, guy, and in that moment I realized, like, see, what hit me, the difference was, the magic words that they said were not that there were so many objections and there were only seven, right? That wasn't it. It was something else they said. They said, we keep getting cut off. We can't get our pitches off. Rich people are assholes. And guess what? That wasn't happening to me. Mm-hmm. People didn't cut me off. I was getting the same objections they were getting, but I get them at the end. Why would someone object before you even asked for the order, right? And what I said to them is, guys, when you're speaking to rich people, people that have money, smart people, and it turns out now everyone's getting pretty smart because we all have smartphones now, right? You have 4 seconds to establish three crucial things, and I'll tell you exactly what they are. Number one, in those first 4 seconds, you must be perceived as being sharp as a tack. Number two, enthusiastic as hell. And number three, most important of all, an expert in your field.
Yeah.
All right? And what really I was saying, and I realized, is that there was something I was doing, some way I sounded, not just at Stratton, but in all the sales jobs I had before that. I broke every record in any company, shattered any record from the time I was 18 years old, outsold everyone, double, triple, right? There was something I was doing, whether it was in person or on the phone, that people were sensing that I'm an expert in my field, I'm sharp, I'm on the ball, to a point that they would defer to me. In other words, what do you do when you're in the presence of an expert, a true expert, or someone you perceive to be? What do? You allow them to control the flow of the encounter. They've earned that right. They're an expert. We've been conditioned to do that since we're yay big. When we were sick, our parents took us to a doctor, right? And when you went to the doctor, even your own parents were like deferring to the doctor, and he dressed a certain way, you know, he had diplomas on the wall, and this man or woman had been to every, you know, taken courses, graduated from university and then medical school. They knew everything there was to know about making sick people healthy. So what did you do? When the doctor would ask you questions, you don't cut the doctor off. Mm. You don't tell him, well, anyway, how do you feel? But you answer the doctor's questions honestly and forthrightedly, because he's an expert. And you know that, so you're trained very young, right? In addition, when an expert is done asking you questions, they don't say, oh, great, well, you have pneumonia, have a nice day. What do? No, they tell you what's wrong and they offer you a prescription, a solution.
Yeah.
So this goes on and on from when you had tutors and coaches when you were growing up, then when you had lawyers and accountants. We seek out experts, right? So this first element of the straight line, which was like a magic bullet in some ways, was just, you know, how do you essentially, because this is the million-dollar question, how do you essentially come off as being sharp as a tack, enthusiastic as hell, and an expert in your field? How do you do that? You have 4 seconds. I mean, is it the words that you say? What could you say in 4 seconds? Hey, Bill, I'm sharp as a tack. I'm enthusiastic. I swear, I'm an expert. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You're like an idiot, right? So the words really don't exist in 4 seconds. Now, you could say the wrong words. Hi, I'm a moron. Nice to meet you. You're not going to say that, right? But at the end of the day, it's not the words that do this so much. It's a combination of two things. It's tonality and body language. In person. In the absence of being in person, body language collapses into tonality, and that is really the secret to this thing. Mm. And there are certain key tonalities, how you sound, the energy that comes through, that immediately position you in the mind of the prospect, like, whoa, this person's an expert, and that buys you enough time. The first 4 or 5 seconds, they're like, whoa, because that's an unconscious reaction they have. It's a gut feeling.
Yeah.
Not based on logic. It's been, wow, this person sounds like an expert, so they defer. Now, going forward, their conscious mind is now looking and listening and saying, Is he really an expert? Is she really an expert? So you know, it's not like you get a hall pass once they the first 4 seconds, but that allows you to then take control of the sale. Now, once you take control of the sale, I could talk forever about this stuff. That's right. So something you invent.
Yeah,
you
my first question, which was, tell me about the straight line.
That's a deadly
that's the
one.
That's the podcast,
right? You know, and but anyway, just to close up this question. So just imagine this, right? If you have control of the encounter, right, it opens up the possibility now for you to run a strategy. Let's say you know that there's certain core elements that must line up. Let's say you know there are certain, there's a series of 7 or 8 questions you need to ask. Mm. Well, if the prospect is in control, good luck trying to, every sale becomes different. They're interrupting you, they're asking you questions. So it's like chaotic, it's a chaotic situation. Yeah. But if you're in control, you could now actually have the whole thing in your mind scripted out. If you're on the phone, you could actually have a script, or you could have all the bullet points and the flow, what comes first, second, all planned out before the encounter. So what I was really, and it turns out that there are core elements that have to line up, and that's part of the straight line. But so what I meant when I said that every sale's the same, it's not that people always say the same things. The point is that you can take control and allow it to unfold along this continuum.
Sure.
Okay. Ask questions in a certain order. You know, have your presentation in a certain. Now, generally, you jump around sometimes a little bit, but it always is moving forward, tight in the straight line. And when I taught this, and it was about a 3-4 hour session that night. And when it was done, everyone was like blown away because, you know, it's much more complex than that. It's as complex as it is, it's very easy to learn. Like, really easy to learn. It's just, it makes so much sense when you finally, you're like, oh my God, it makes so much sense, right? So that night, at the end of the night, we're like, I think that was like really great. Like, I think that I got through them and everyone was really pumped, but the market was closed, so everyone went home. Next morning, they came back in, 9 a.m., we start calling, market opens, 9:30, and these 12 formerly Bailey Post adolescent nincompoops formerly went on an account opening spree of such biblical proportions that within 3 months they were all millionaires. And what happens, they all start calling their friends, so people started trickling in and then pouring it from all over the country. And Stratton became the largest firm in the country, like overnight, because of the straight line system. That was really the linchpin.
And why would they wouldn't want to leave if they're working for a company?
Yeah.
If they're millionaire, and that's the thing about sales. If you know how to sell well, you can have your own company. You can work in somebody else's company.
Doesn't matter.
No, you can make a lot of money whatever you do.
So that's the difference with sales. Commission-based sales is one of the few things where I say, if you want to get rich, own your own business, or be a commission-based salesman in brokerage and real estate. Very often, it's better to work for a company. You can own one. It's great to own one, but it's just as good, if not better. Because you can leverage off of the reputation, the capital base, the flow of leads, right? So there's advantages in those. Not many industries, but there's some where really working for a company, a good one that gives you a great commission payout, they make more money.
When I started, I guess every business is sales, but my deal selling business, which was, as you know, finding properties, packaging them and selling them to investors. I hired somebody, a lady, who was an estate agent previously, making about £2,000 a month. And I gave her a commission of what she'd get when she sold. And I was jealous of her because I was thinking, man, she's making almost as much money as I'm making. And I'm having to do all the delivery, taxes, the this, the that, the operations, the admin, the bookkeeping, manage all the staff. She's just rocking into the office, bang, 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 bang. And she's making crazy money.
Yeah. It's one of the few industry sales where if you're in commission base, you can make unlimited amounts of money.
More money than
and also
surgeons.
Some companies will allow you to build a team around yourself. So you're like almost running a business within their business, and then it's entrepreneurial as well. So you are in business for yourself.
What do you think is the best thing to sell then? So we're I can't wait for this conference, by the way, today. It's going to be incredible. But these guys are property guys. Which I think is just a great thing to sell.
Yeah, property is big, right? Listen, there's certain industries, right, where you say, okay, well, what does the average big hitter make in an industry, right? You go like, okay, what's the top 5 people who sell plumbing supplies? What do they make? They may make $100,000, $200,000, you know, dollars or pounds a year, right? You know, what's the top person make that's selling like just computer services or something, just basic computer support. Maybe they make $500,000 a year, right? What is an top insurance salesman? Maybe they make $1 million or $2 million a year. What does a top property person make? And the top Wall Street, they make $10 million, $50 million. You know, like I was out with a friend last night, Nick Candy, one of the biggest property developers in the country here, all right? Multi-billionaire, right? I mean, property's the deal. It's great, right? Properties, stocks, investments, financial stuff, that's really where the big money is in terms of selling. Now, there's many things you could sell, but just, again, some industries, they just, you're dealing with much larger transactions. There's leverage involved because you can get loans on these things. So again, if you're making a 3% or 5% commission on something or whatever it might be, but it's on $2 million, it's a lot better than if you're selling a $69 faucet or a wrench. Yeah. I mean, like it just gives you more leverage.
If you're a lemonade stand, you're only gonna get paid pennies per sale.
Yeah, you gotta sell a lot of shit ton of lemonade, you know?
But I think that selling to rich people, selling expensive products and services to rich people is easier than selling cheap products and services to broke people?
Yeah, well, number one is that typically cheap services are commoditized. There's like a lot of people selling the same thing. And also, you know, you can be more bespoke with larger, you know, transactions and very wealthy people. But again, if you're going to deal with those wealthy people, you have to sound a certain way. Mm-hmm. You have to be perceived a certain way. Then that's when really the rules of the straight line system, the ability, because if you go to a rich person, you sound like a moron. Good luck trying to sell them real estate. Why would I buy from you? You know.
So it's not just about the script. It's also about the way you say it. It's about the tonality. There's all that, isn't there, that you need to factor
in? Yeah, it's a combination of it's what you say, the way you say it, and when you say it.
I've heard people following my scripts, but they just say it wrong.
Yeah.
And if the closing close might be, how would you like to pay?
Right.
They say, how would you like to pay?
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it's like,
how would you like to pay versus how would you like to pay, you know?
Right, exactly.
No big deal.
Yeah, exactly. And also asking questions like, one of the things that a lot of bad guys do is they'll rent properties and then they'll rent them out on Airbnb, like rental arbitrage. I think they call it in the States.
Yeah.
But getting agents and landlords to entrust you with their properties is a key component to it, which is a sales call.
Well, I think the point is that, like, and this is an interesting story. Like, a lot of times I'll get hired by very large companies, right? And one time I was in Australia, actually, was hired by a massive appliance company, right? And they had two parts of their business. They sold appliances, dishwashers, refrigerators, freezers, whatever else, right? Stoves. They did pretty well with that. And I went down there and I was able to increase their sales by like 20% by meeting with like 500 of their salespeople, right? But where I really, really helped them, where like I blew up their profits, was not on the actual sale, but on the warranty that came after. In other words, after you buy a TV or something, they're like, do you want a 3-year warranty? It's for like three, right? And everyone was saying, nah, like they'd sell like 2% of the people a warranty. I'm like, guys, the warranty is a separate sale.
Yeah.
And he's his own script and sales process. And I taught them how to use the straight line to sell the warranty. And 70% of the people would take warranties.
Yeah.
Because they were presented the right way. Not like, you get this, that's, you want it? No, it was like, listen, let me tell you exactly why this is, you know, something you should really consider and blah, blah, blah. And then stepping down from there's a 3-year to the 2-year. And so, you know, you had this thing where they, at least everyone would take the 1 year, right? And they would make more money on the warranties than on the actual TV or the appliance there where the margins are very thin, right? So what you're saying is very true. In other words, you get someone to want to say, I like to rent out my house, but the Airbnb, like separate issue.
Yeah.
So like that's a sale into itself.
It's like you said that, the objections that they come up with. I did the exact same thing. I think I got it from you actually. Initially, I think I must have been spot because I did the same thing, which is, I said to everybody, I got them all on the phones and then said, what were the objections you got? We came up with 21 and a lot of them were doubled over and stuff as well like that. But there's not that many objections. And when you know what objection is going to come, when you know ahead, you say, at some point they're going to say they need to speak to their wife.
Right.
And when they say that, I'm going to expect and I'm going to deal with
it. Yeah. And I think also that, you know, understanding what objections really are, that they're basically smoke screens for uncertainty. In other words, people are uncertain maybe about the value product proposition or the product, whatever it is, something about the product. Maybe they're uncertain about you. They don't trust you. They think you're trying to just sell them something. Maybe they're uncertain about the company that, you know, is managing the whole thing, right? But people don't typically come out and say, I don't trust you. Mm. Or I don't like it. I don't think it's a good enough deal. They'll say, oh yeah, it sounds really good. Let me think about it. It sounds good. Let me call you back. I got to speak to my wife. Those people hit you with objections because they're not certain, yeah, or at least certain enough. So, I mean, imagine, let's say you're going to sell someone a property, right? And by the time you're done explaining it, the person that you're trying to sell to is 100% convinced that this is an amazing deal. Amazing. Let's say they're also 100% convinced that you are trustworthy. You're not going to screw them over in any way, right? Let's say you've sold them 10 deals in the past and everyone was a home run. Mm. And then let's say the company that you work for, one of your employees, the name of the company is a prestigious, well-known company with a great reputation. They know they only deal in quality. They're trustworthy. They're going to guarantee things. There's not going to be scams or problems or liens, right? So let's say they're 100% certain about that, right? And they're financially qualified. Will they buy? Of course they will. If they have the money and they're 100% sure it's an amazing deal, they've done 10 deals with you and everyone had made them a fortune, they trust, of course they're going to buy.
Yeah.
So what happens when someone says, let me call you back, send me some information, or I got to speak to someone, what they're saying is, I need to speak to someone because I'm not 100% sure, yeah, this is a great deal, or I want to check you out or do some research. So objections, for the very most part, I mean, sometimes people say, I don't have the money, and they very could not have the money. It's possible, right? And there's ways you can figure out if an objection is real. But for the most part, they're smoke screens for uncertainty. And the mistake that people make is that when they get hit with an objection, they try to rebut the objection and then ask for the order again. But that doesn't work because, yeah, all they'll do is hop to a different objection, because what you haven't really uncovered is what's beneath the objection.
You've got to get to the level of it, find out what the root problem is.
But the root problem is going to be they're, yeah, uncertain about something. So the key with the straight line is, how do you take that objection and answer it in a way that makes the person comfortable, but also use it as an opportunity to increase their certainty for these key elements. Mm. And if necessary, go back to what their pain points are and even lower their, what's called their action threshold, the way they weigh decisions in their minds. And by using these five elements, they're almost like the numbers of a combination of a safe deal, of a lock, yeah, of a safe, right? Now, some safes, right, like the ones in gym class, they had three, I don't know if you have to say three numbers, right, left, they're master locks, yeah, typical, right? You know, by the way, they're pretty easy to crack those. Like any safe cracker that has any experience, it's three numbers, I'll crack. They're easy to open. But you have to open them, but they're easy, right? Then you have those like Israeli safes. They're like five numbers, impossible to crack, right? Those are the more difficult ones, right? You have to line up all five numbers in the right order, then the safe will open. Mm. The same thing is true with the safe of the human mind when it comes to buying decisions. There are these numbers or these elements, and you have to line them up. If you get all three elements lined up, you have a good shot, because if someone's easier versus harder to close, the way their mind is sort of structured, how they make decisions and so forth, right, then three might be enough. But then you might find you need the Israeli tactics, the last two, right? And those are the harder people to close. But by having control over those five core elements, these essentially five numbers of the buying combination, you know, you get to this point with a straight line when you get proficient where you can close anyone who's closable.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is not that you're going to close everyone, but it's not like you're not going to close someone. You say, I screwed it up. Jordan could have closed it, or you could have closed it. You get to this point, they don't buy, you say, you know what? They weren't going to buy, but it's not because of me. I didn't screw, yeah, it up. And that's a really powerful, empowering place to be, because once you feel that level of confidence, what you realize is that sales now becomes a numbers game.
Yeah.
If you just speak to enough people and you're great at what you do and you don't blow it, even because the worst thing is, imagine like they were great, but you blew it. I mean, then it becomes like, what's the point? It's an exercise in futility. People, yeah, don't want to work hard. They get demotivated and so forth.
So you got to get the skills and then hit the numbers.
Correct.
Speak to lots of people.
Yeah.
What are you working on now then? So we know your story from the movie, obviously, and you've now got a lot of different businesses.
Yeah.
Travel the world.
Yeah, yeah.
You got your speaking, your training. Yeah. Where do you make
the most exciting thing I'm working on now is artificial intelligence.
What do you mean?
So basically, it's I have a company which is growing very fast right now. It's some really great minds, great AI people, and they're engineers. And I have taught myself, you know, how to do coding and stuff. And
they'll
really? Yeah.
You taught yourself how to do coding?
I did. Yeah, wow. Python and stuff. But you know, the truth is nowadays the AIs do most of the coding for you. If you just do a little bit of it, they'll help you
out. What is it then? What does the company do, or what's the AI?
What it does is it's an AI that can close. It sounds like a human being.
Wow.
And it's incredible. And it's a voice that could speak in any language, any accent. And we trained a model on the straight line. So it sounds like me, but it's, you know, and it makes phone calls as many as you want. And it will either qualify people.
Will the person know that they're talking to a machine?
If you want them to, they wouldn't know if you didn't tell them.
No.
You would never know.
No.
You would never.
You're kidding. You genuinely think you're talking to a person?
100%.
That's mad.
Yeah, I'll play your tape later. You would never know. You know, I don't want to do it on camera because it's a client, and that you know, this one's for political.
That is mad.
We do stuff in political campaigns.
So you could make it sound like you as well.
So it could sound just like me.
So I could think I was talking to the real Jordan.
Absolutely, Michael. You wouldn't know the difference. That's ridiculous. Has the right tone now. So we trained the model.
Is that not scary though? Is that not a bit scary? What do you think about the whole deep fakes and stuff? You must have people doing deep fakes.
I have. But I mean, listen. You know, we're just like, you know, we don't deal with that stuff, right? Deep fakes. We're dealing with, in fact, we don't even use famous voices.
Yeah.
Like at all. It's not about, what we're doing is looking for a voice. For example, if we're calling London, if we have a client in London that's using it, we're not going to use a US. We use a voice with a London accent. Maybe we're going to use a man, a woman. It could be certain ethnic.
So this software is ready to go now. You're selling it now.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm selling it quietly now because we have very, very, very large clients, okay? Because it's at the point right now where we're still training the model in the sense that I have to go in there right now with the AI and train it to make sure that what it generates is perfect. And that so we deal with huge clients, enterprise-level clients that spend massive money. Right? But we're very close, I would say probably 3 to 6 months away from having it self-serve where anybody, because you know, with a user interface where you can just say, here's my business, here's what I want to do, here's a sample of the five last calls that did well, here's five shitty calls, here are my scripts, here's every background knowledge, and you just feed it into the machine and you ask how often do you want this person called? If they don't answer the first time you want them called back, it does what's called agentic workflows. So it'll not only start the process, it'll follow up, it'll send them emails and texts, it'll freaking collect evidence from them, it'll scan it. It creates files. It's insane.
Will you not do yourself out of a profession in teaching people how to sell if you've just created AI that will sell for them?
So
I conflict of interest.
On some level, it's the innovator's dilemma, right? You know, right? But I think that there's always going to be a job for great salespeople.
Can I just say something really important? When you were talking, I was feeling conflicted in my mind because I literally just said recently a speech that AI is going to take your job, but the only job it won't take is if you're a deal maker. If you know how to sell, you're saying it can, and you're responsible for creating the machinery.
Right. But. Right, you know what we're using it for right now is we're like, for example, we're qualifying people to a certain point, and then getting someone that's very close, and then we pass it to a human salesperson to close.
Now
it can close itself too, really well. It can. But for right now. Okay, because you know, again, you're right. There's this issue of replacing salespeople. Let me give you an example though of a better version of that. So let's say you have 50 people, okay? Imagine a system where you're advertising on Facebook and Instagram or TikTok, right? And you're getting a lot, thousands and thousands of incoming leads every single day, right?
Mm.
And those leads are then people that want to be called back because they, you know, said, call me back, I'm interested in property, whatever, right? Then you have 50 salespeople who sit there and dial the phone, right? Or press a button and dial and try to get in and get them to start to see if they qualify, right, if they fit the program, right? So the average person can maybe close 2 a day, right? Because they spend so much time trying to get someone on the phone. What you would do in that case is the AI, you'd feed all this, the AI would automatically scrape all the leads every single day. And the AI is going to do all of that initial process.
Sure.
And when it gets someone who's qualified and who's interested, they'll say, okay, hold on for a senior representative who will explain how easy it is to get started. And they say, great, and it transfers. So now, let's say you had 50 salespeople closing, let's say, two a day. Mm-hmm. You could have 10 salespeople closing 10 a day.
Right.
So, because they're so efficient. So the great, good salespeople are always going to be, but the weaker salespeople, yes, they're going to get replaced.
And that's the thing, isn't it? It's like when you go to a grocery store, now it's all machines, but they're still the supervisor if the machine can't do it.
Listen, and the machines kind of suck at that self-scan stuff. They kind of suck. I hate them, right? But you know what's happening? The tech is getting better. Listen, I'm going to just say flat out to the camera, whether you like it or not, this is happening. Okay, this is happening. In the next 3 to 5 years, businesses are going to fundamentally be disrupted at very deep levels, including large system of record companies.
AI like, is taking your job.
Well, like just the system of record companies like Salesforce, HubSpot, all of these large CRMs, they are gonna have to reprice or figure something out because AI is able to do a lot of this at a fraction of the cost.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think is the future of money? What do you think is going to happen to the U.S. dollar, the pound?
I think that people have a misconception about crypto and its role in the world. I don't look at crypto as currency, so to speak. I look at Bitcoin, especially Bitcoin, which I own a lot of. All right, Bitcoin is a store of value. All right, you're not going to use Bitcoin and go out and buy a pizza. That some guy did that early on and really screwed up. You're worth like $7 billion right now, right? But you're not going to use crypto to go buy, you know, a day-to-day transaction. Maybe you use stable coins, but you wouldn't. And there's no reason to have those unless you're in certain countries. Like in certain countries with these unstable currencies, right?
Yeah.
Yes, that definitely works. But I think that the dollar and the pound is digital right now. Now, there's still bills out there, right? But like, you know, honestly, the percentage of, I brought like $300 or $400 in cash to London.
You don't need it.
I used to come here with 10 grand, nine grand.
Yeah, you couldn't spend it
if you brought it, right?
No, but cash, we are becoming a cashless society.
So I'm saying, so really, let's say we are almost a cashless society, you know, there's no difference from the dollar. It's all, you look at this as a serial number, 100, same thing on your, I assume on your pounds have serial numbers, right? So they're all digital, right? The main difference is that one, okay, is decentralized. Like Bitcoin's a decentralized, no one's in control of it, no one person. The miners have a lot of gold, starting to concentrate with these big ETFs, but theoretically no one's in control of it. While in central bank situations, they can print more, they can use monetary policy to try to, you know, control economics, and which usually causes problems, like the recent bout of inflation we went through in the United States. I mean, it was
huge.
Also here, right?
Yeah, huge.
And not as bad, but you still had it here, right?
Oh, yeah, it was bad here.
Yeah, yes.
Over 11% in 2022.
Caused by what? Printing money during COVID. You can't print money and think that it's not going to cause inflation. It does every single time. It's like it's a direct relationship, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think in terms of the future of money is I just think that, yeah, there'll be, when you say a digital dollar, like versus a US dollar, the only difference would be is how they keep track of it. It would give the governments a lot more ability to see what you're spending and on where the money's moving. I don't like it. And that's a dystopian sort of situation.
No, that is what's happening. And I think that they're going to hijack cryptocurrency, the governments.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I'll say to me, most of cryptocurrencies.
They already are doing that though in China. Yeah. And they're banning Bitcoin, they're banned it in China.
Listen, well, most of cryptocurrency is complete nonsense.
It is.
99%.
Yeah, it is.
Complete nonsense.
Yeah.
It's tokens created by people to want to get rich.
But the blockchain is genius.
The blockchain is genius. It's different. But the crypto is a very different thing. Blockchain
is
a decentralized ledger. That's awesome. And even the governments are using it and brokers are using it to settle transactions more quickly and so forth, right? But what happens with crypto is that there are so many charlatans and scams.
Pump and dumps.
It's just that there's no use cases.
Yeah.
There's no legitimate use cases. Now, in terms of Bitcoin, legitimate use case, it's an amazing store of value, and it's proven itself. And now it's like the lie becomes the truth. I used to hate Bitcoin. I hated it back in the day. I was like, and I was right back then in the sense it was 17,000, it crashed down to 2,000. So I was right. And I was wrong. I thought it was. Yeah. I thought it was going to die, and then it came back. And I'm like, "What? 10,000? Like, what's going on?" Because things that crash like that were pyramids never come back. And that's when I took a deeper look at it. And someone, thankfully, a friend of mine, says, "Listen, you got to look at the mathematics of this, the sort of what it really is." And as I really looked under the hood, I'm like, "Wow, this is fucking genius." And I started buying it around like 15,000, luckily, and I bought a ton. And I've been, I bought three last week. You know, three Bitcoin last week I bought, you know?
Yeah.
And a little cash lying around. I bought three more and I just keep buying, you know?
We're going to wrap up shortly because we've got an event to run. Are you excited about the event?
I am.
We're going to kill it, man.
I love it.
What was it that made you agree to come down, spend the whole day with me, do a podcast, run an event? What made you say yes?
I know you're very choosy about
who you work with and different things.
I don't do nearly as many speeches because I'm just busy with my own businesses right now, right? And consulting. But number one, I love London. And I always check out the event that I'm doing. Because sometimes I did so many, you find out they're fucking scammers. And I don't know. I booked 200 events and like one person's doing something wrong. And they're like, oh, he was a speaker at the event. So now I very carefully vet where I speak. So I saw you were totally legit. I love the property industry. And I think the straight line's a great fit for it. So I, you know, and also come see my friends in London. So it was a win-win for everyone, you know? Well, here I am.
I'm super excited. I'm really grateful that you've come down. I just want to say thank you because you've been not just inspiration. A lot of people are inspirations and they have personal development and mindset, which is really important. But what you do, which is different, is you actually teach
the strategy,
which is missing a lot of the time.
Yeah.
People talk about mindset and mindset.
It's important too.
It is. It is. So many people need that. And if you've not got the belief in your product, the belief in your mind, you will fail miserably.
Exactly.
But there's not many people that are out there teaching the actual strategy.
It's very
Here's
rare.
What you do. Here's what you say. So I love that about you. And I'm glad, man. So we're going to kill it today. And
good.
Appreciate you coming on, bro.
My pleasure.